are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, February 8th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, David Galumbia, associate professor in the Department of English and the Media Art and Text, the Virginia Commonwealth University, author of The Politics of Bitcoin, Software as Right-Wing Extremism. Also on the program today, facing a deadline, the House looking to pass the Senate budget deal, Dems looking to cave on DACA. Meanwhile, and just in time too, ICE also wants to be a spy agency. Meanwhile, back at the White House, they have known for almost a year that John Kelly's right-hand man, a wife beater, a wives beater. Meanwhile, the U.S. now battling Syrian troops. Joe Lieberman is still alive, and Democratic grifters have been exposed. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. We'll get to that last story probably the second half of the program. My plan is to, we recorded this interview with David Galumbia, I think it was a couple of days ago. And after that, Kyle, our own very own Kyle, is going to call in and explain blockchain technology, which is the technology that undergirds cryptocurrencies and other things. And he'll explain that to us because he knows all that stuff. He's very, very computer literate. He took one of those computer classes, so he knows all about them. I will get to this other story about this guy, Dworkin. You know, I feel like I recognize the name. Like, he's all over the place. Do you know what I'm talking about? This is the story.
Dworkin? No.
There was a story in the Daily Beast about the Democratic Coalition. It's a PAC that was started by, the senior advisor was this guy, Scott Dworkin.
Yes, he's a real Mick Resistance sort of Twitter personality, I think.
And he has this PAC that apparently Lachlan Mark A. and Sam Stein over at the Daily Beast had did a deep dive into. And apparently it's one of those PACs where it's like, I feel like I've run into this once or twice before. I don't meet a lot of people who are involved in PACs.
Name names. Let's risk us.
But the, I think that if people really scour the archives, they could find, people could figure this out. I don't want to speak out of turn. Because, you know, some of what I'm talking about is conjecture. But so hypothetically speaking, it seems to me that what some people do is, someone like I could start a pack. I mean, anybody could. But the idea would be I start a pack. I wouldn't call it the SS pack. That would be pretty bad branding, I think, in this day and age. But let's say I called it the Democratic Victory 2018 pack.
Very, very good name.
It's pretty good.
Good. It's like a stock image name. I love it.
I mean, I think I could probably already find stickers that are already been printed with that.
Right, right.
And the Democratic Victory 2018 PAC, I am the executive director of the PAC. I go out, I raise money from, let's say, this audience. And the implication is I'm raising money for a Democratic victory in 2018. Now, that's a very broad mandate, isn't it? I mean, does anybody here know what would assure that? No. Maybe what would assure it is me flying around the country and talking up a Democratic victory. Like, let's say I'm going to do this podcast in Philly, Chicago, Vegas, probably multiple shows in Vegas. We're going to do it in L.A. We probably also should do one in Tulum, Mexico, because it could be expats. It may catch some people on vacation.
A big vote.
Lisbon, maybe.
Lisbon.
Tuscany.
We're going to take the show on the road to ensure a 2018 victory. Now, of course, look, got to pay us. So we pay us all. Of course, I'm going to get like a multiple of whatever you guys get, but that's just the way it's going to be. I mean,
of course,
that's part of the charter of the Democratic victory 2018. And then we end up, when we're all done, about 80% of the money has been used up to fund our travel and, of course, payment. And then the other 20% maybe goes towards, like, I don't know, some bumper stickers. And boom, we've called it a day. We raised $750,000. We're all a little bit wiser, a little bit wealthier, and hopefully closer to that 2018 Democratic victory. And that seems to be what this Democratic coalition was about. And then you also hear stories about, like, I'm not going to take any money whatsoever. It's just going to pay for things like the office here. Like, I could do it this way. I could do it like, where I'm not going to take any money from this. Going to pay for the office. Going to pay for our travel to get to the Chicago show. But guess what? I get the door. I get the money coming in from the door. So all the costs are going to be taken care of, but I'm not going to take any money personally from it. I'm just going to set up all these vehicles to make me money.
That's about the purpose. It's about the mission.
And so, this has been something that has been going on for a long time on the right. They just have so much money they can afford to do that. On the left, I think we're seeing more of that now because of things like social media.
Right.
And also the fact that a lot of people are coming in from the sidelines and getting into the game. And so there's more of that going on.
And in some ways, if I may say, it makes, if somebody is doing that particular grift and targeting people on the center or the left and utilizing social media, it's more sleazy, because on the right, like, great, like, grift all the multimillionaire donors you want. But when you're like hitting up, freaked out suburbanites for $50 on Twitter, that's a lot more messed
there,
up.
I mean, according to this story, there's a mix, because you don't get a sense.
Well, I'm speaking in general. I mean, right. I'm just saying.
No, fair enough. I mean,
I just love those Republican stories sometimes when it's like, like, I remember, who's the family that owned the Cubs? They're a really disgusting family.
Ricketts.
And there was this whole expose of them before the Obama reelect, where these really sleazy Republican consultants did the whole thing to them. We're like, nobody told the real Obama story. Nobody spread, like, nobody talked about Jeremiah right enough. And it was totally disgusting. But the upshot was basically just like hack consultants, going and telling, like, gullible rich reactionaries nonsense, and probably getting a payday,
right?
Fair enough.
I mean, that's biz. But this guy Dworkin, who they say in the who they talk about in the piece, his Twitter handle is Funder, which is sort of funny because it sounds more like he's more the recipient than the actual funder.
At recipient.
That would be a good Twitter handle.
Well, that being said, I don't feel that well, and I'm going to go. I got some work to do.
Right.
We need to take down Trump.
All right, let's go. Speaking of candidates, here is Allison Camerota interviewing the. This is the candidate who looks like will be who will have the Republican nomination for Congress. Where is it, where will he be running? Where? In Illinois, right?
Yeah, outside Chicago.
In the 3rd District?
Yeah.
Do you know how many people he ran against? Now, they haven't had the election yet, right? The primary yet?
No.
But he's polling. He's polling well right now. And it turns out, well, he's not, he hasn't been affiliated with the Nazis in a formal sense in probably over a decade. That's the best we can say about this guy.
A former leader of the American Nazi Party is running for Congress in Illinois. As the only Republican on the ticket, it looks like he is about to win the primary next month.
There you go.
His name is Arthur Jones. He has never disavowed his Nazi views. Here's what Jones said at a rally in Kentucky last April. And we warn all of you
they're
that
nice. They're good people on both
sides. The language you're about to hear in this segment is offensive.
The white majority are fed up with all of these lying, cheating, thieving, warmongering, child molesting, political pimps and whores of this corrupt and decadent two-party, Jew-party, queer party system.
Arthur Jones.
All right, pause it for one second. I just wanted to, the two-party, Jew-party, queer system is one of the things he's railing against. But, you know, this is really important to, and we're going to have some interviews, you know, over the break in about a week or so. They're going to be talking about the taxonomy of fascists and through the conservative movement. And, when you listen to Donald Trump, you're hearing a white nationalist, okay? And on some level, not like this guy, but you can hear the echoes, right? We've got it. We've got a rotting establishment. They're rigging the system. In this case, it's the two-party system, Jew party system, queer system. Is part of the problem.
New segment on my show.
But also, it is, you know, there is, we need to protect our people. And that is the sort of the construct. Some of the adjectives change a little bit depending on who your audience is. In this case, he has a National Socialist banner behind him with multiple neo-Nazi emblems. So he can be a little bit more explicit. But continue.
System.
Arthur Jones, that Republican candidate for Illinois' 3rd District, joins us now. Mr. Jones, it is shocking to hear how vocally and unapologetically racist you are. Are you a Nazi?
Well, for the past 15, 20 years, I have not had anything to do with any National Socialist organization on a formal basis.
But do you call yourself a Nazi?
I did have
as in a formal basis. He hasn't had. I haven't been a formally. I mean, this is the whole point, right? When people say, like, how can you put people in the alt-right, fascist right on the same continuum? Because they are on the same continuum, and they have a. An explicit agenda of being of an understanding that they need to distance themselves to expand their reach. So this guy, I haven't had any formal involvement with these people for 15 years.
He's not doing a very good job of distancing
himself. No, this guy's not good. This guy's not a very bright guy.
Wait,
but you can imagine
a bright
guy. Well, no, he just spoke there. He had no official involvement. Look, don't try and squelch free speech or the exchange of ideas. He was just going there and speaking.
Exactly. Well, now I also understand, because Matt was explaining to me once that he has no official involvement with the Majority Report.
Right.
And I never understood that before.
Right.
On a formal basis.
But do you call yourself a Nazi?
I don't call myself a Nazi. I call myself an American patriot and statesman.
Okay, well, let me give
Nazi
our viewers some details about this just so they can decide for themselves. You've been part of anti-Semitic groups since the 1970s. You go to neo-Nazi rallies. We have pictures of you there.
Well,
you were part of the White People's Party.
You
dress in Nazi garb, and you celebrate Hitler's birthday.
I like cosplay.
You're a Nazi.
Well, I do not belong to any formal National Socialist organization anymore, and I haven't belonged to one since about 1990, okay? Mm-hmm. The only organization that I belong to...
Now, pause it. Now, I know we have some young people who listen to this program. Let me tell you, back in the 90s, everybody was a Nazi. Everybody.
It was like Range Rovers.
Different times.
Snow. Such a Ace of Base. Oh, wait, really, actually.
Really different. Really different time. I mean, if you wore any boots that were even like halfway up your calf, people would look at you funny. You needed to go all the way up and goose step that.
The only organization that I belong to is my own organization, and that's the America First Committee. Uh-huh. Okay?
America First. You can call it whatever you want, Mr. Jones, but your website is filled with the most vile, rancid rhetoric I think I've ever read.
I disagree with you. It's not vile and rancid. It's the truth.
It is?
There's nothing on that website that's not true. I personally put that stuff on there.
Yeah.
I personally picked out the articles on there because they're true.
I mean, I would like her to have, like, said, like, you know, gone through the list of those articles a little bit more. Maybe she did a little bit later. But the point of this is, here's a guy who's clearly, you know, this guy's no brain surgeon. Or, I mean, I guess.
You say that.
That's been sort of ruined for us, too. But the point being that here's a guy who is basically following the game plan for what we're seeing with Nazis, Nazi lighters trying to expand their reach. This guy is a little bit more ham-fisted, although he may end up being the nominee for the Republican Party.
Sam, I know you like to mock and not engage with people's ideas, but I found the website actually very captivating. So maybe you should read it and stop denying your own power. And he's just, I don't know, I think he's kind of a cute old man. I wish I could just inject some blood in him.
This
make him a little bit less sad.
Now, the filing
Allison
deadline...
Camarado, I hate her so much.
The deadline was December 4th. This primary takes place in March 20th. This is Lipinski's district, where you have Marie Newman is running against him and has been endorsed. The challenger to Lipinski has been endorsed by at least two other Democratic congresspeople in the Chicago area. So, but this is how it goes, folks. I mean, this is the structure of how these things work.
I mean, I've been critical in the past of the kind of entryism where more radical elements can take over a mainstream party, but the right seems to be doing a pretty good job at it. So maybe I should take a second look.
This has been an ongoing project for 15, 20 years. I mean, maybe more, but certainly over the past 15 years, we've seen it sort of lurch in this direction.
If we were as good at it as Republicans are, we would probably have communists running for Congress by now.
Let's hope.
2020.
All right, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, David Galumbia on the politics of Bitcoin software as right-wing extremism. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Associate Professor in the English Department at Virginia Commonwealth University, David Galumbia, author of The Politics of Bitcoin, Software as Right-Wing Extremism. Welcome to the program, David.
Thanks a lot. I'm glad to be here.
Okay, so let's, for those of us who are uneducated in this area, and... give us a sense of what. Let's start first with Bitcoin. I think most people are familiar, broadly speaking, with the notion of cryptocurrencies. Bitcoin is one of them. There now are many of them. But give us a broad overview so that we're all on the same page, at least with what your definition of it is.
Sure. There are, as you mentioned, actually, there's probably right now 1,200 or something like that cryptocurrencies out there. They come and go, and many are not widely traded, but there's a ton of them. So cryptocurrencies is part of a project that some of the insiders in the digital world, they go by names like crypto anarchists and cypherpunks, have been promoting for a long time, since the early 1990s. They have a strong desire to what they consider build some kind of cash system that is outside of the state and outside of government control. And in the works of these people, it's very clear that the point of this is to try to tear apart government and regulation.
Before we get to that part of the argument, I give us just a straightforward, and I guess part of it is that there is no neutrality in this concept, but give us a taxidermy of these things as possible.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard because you've got Bitcoin, you've got the currency itself on the one hand, right? Bitcoin, the thing that we talk about, its price, which is the easiest way, I think, to think about it is that it's like a stock, right? It's a ticker. It has a ticker symbol, BTC, and you can go buy some of it for however much money you want. And then if you're like one of these people in the Bitcoin world, you hope it goes way up and you can sell it for double, triple, eight times what you bought it for. And you don't need to get involved with the software at all to do that. You can just go out and do that on exchanges, which are kind of the equivalent of a brokerage account, although much less well-regulated. And you can do that for any of these currencies, right? And to most people who are dealing with this, that's all they see. It just looks like another stock they can buy, but it isn't, doesn't trade on some official market.
Now, we should say, though, that there is at least a hope, and to some extent in practice, that it functions less as a stock and more as a currency, right? Where you could actually pay for things with it. I could pay for something with a stock, but very few places will take it. There's attempts to take Bitcoin in the same way that you would take any other currency. Those seem to be ebbing and flowing. I think Stripe, which is a payment system that we use for this show, no longer takes Bitcoin longer has a system to take it, but it did as of, I think, like 3 weeks ago. But that's also the hope, too, right? That it's a currency.
That is supposedly the primary hope. I mean, that's why we call them cryptocurrencies. And when you read the original papers that were that eventually resulted in Bitcoin, all they talked about was currency in the sense of something you could buy something else with. And in fact, when Bitcoin had its first surge in value, people were really noticing it because it was being used to purchase stuff, especially on the so-called dark web, the most infamous drug supermarket on the dark web, the Silk Road, which was run by a guy named Ross Ulbricht, who's now in jail. Bitcoin was the currency you used to buy stuff. And so there was a lot of currency-like use of Bitcoin for a while. But that use has actually gone down. And it's, as you said, Stripe stopped taking it. There have been a few companies that have taken it, and they've walked away from it, in part because of its volatility, because it goes up so much in value. And that's part of the sort of contradictions you run into when you talk to people about it, because it's often the very same people talking about how great it is that it keeps going up 1,000% in value in a few months, and then saying it's a great currency. And of course, for a currency, you really want it to stay the same price, not to go up or down over a period of time, for a lot of, very clear economic reasons.
Right, and practical ones. I mean, if I was to take Bitcoin in lieu of, let's say, $10 a month, I would constantly have to be adjusting how much Bitcoin I take on a moment-to-moment daily basis.
That's right. And there'd be a huge, and if you were a producer or a farmer or something like that, there would be a very strong disincentive to ever actually produce your product, because you would probably be better off just holding the Bitcoin and, you know, having it double or triple in value. And that is really, that's, you know, deflation, hyper deflation, and it is deeply undesirable from an economic perspective.
Okay. So, but we have an explanation of what Bitcoin, I guess, aspires to be and what it is. It's how would, when you make the assertion that it is being used less as currency, what, how do we know that? I mean, is that anecdotal, or is there some type of, like, is there somebody who measures this?
There are people who measure it, but you're not wrong in that it is hard to measure it, because Bitcoin, all a Bitcoin transaction is moving some amount of coins, you know, a decimal point number usually, from one address, which is just a string of letters and numbers, to another address, which is a string of letters and numbers. And just looking at that, it's very hard to tell whether somebody did that in order to, you know, make some gains, like in the stock market, or whether they bought something with it. There are some sophisticated tools that people use that they know some of the addresses, like, you know, if a major merchant decides to accept Bitcoin, they usually assign an address or several addresses to that, to their site, in order to take Bitcoin, and they can look at that site and see how much Bitcoin has gone there. So you can, you know, if somebody were to send some Bitcoin to
Stripe,
you know, Amazon, Stripe, right? You could see that Stripe had received X Bitcoin, and you could infer that that was probably to buy something. It's much harder when you look at the other piece of data that you can look at, which is easier, is what merchants say they accept Bitcoin.
Right.
And that number has gone down. Rather, I mean, it initially went up a little bit, but it's actually gone down. And I think one of the major financial publications, maybe the Wall Street Journal, or maybe it was Forbes, I can't remember, but they put up a chart of, like, which Fortune 500 companies accept Bitcoin. And I think there was, like, one about 2 years ago, and that's gone down to zero. And that's a pretty clear number that we can all
agree
on.
And before we get to blockchain, because I want to talk about blockchain, what about other cryptocurrencies? Ethereum, I think, is one that whose name I hear more, or Litecoin is another one that,
yep,
I hear more, which seems to be a derivative of Bitcoin, or Bitcoin Cash. Explain,
yep,
to us what those are before we get to blockchain technology.
Yeah, there's different kinds of them, right? And some of them, like Bitcoin Cash, for example, is where some of the developers of the Bitcoin software decided that they had written a better version of the software. And so a few people are now running this alternate version of the Bitcoin software, and that uses this other token called Bitcoin Cash. In some cases, and we can actually talk about this in a minute, they aren't actually independent pieces of software. You may have heard about, recently there's this thing called initial coin offerings, or ICOs, which are a really problematic development, where new companies form around issuing a new token, the market for these has just gone crazy, and there's things like Banana Coin and Garlic Coin and all kinds of stuff, and they seem very scammy, and all of these are actually run on the Ethereum blockchain. They don't have their own separate blockchain, but you can... So it's hard to see, like, who's running the software and who's just trying to sell this stuff for, you know, to make money off it. And, of course, unlike a true initial public offering, where if you buy the stock, you own a part of the company, in most of the initial coin offerings, you don't own anything. You just have this token that may or may not be worth anything in the future, but it's unrelated to whether the company does well.
All right. And so, and lastly, I mean, this concept of mining Bitcoins, my understanding is that there is an algorithm that progressively gets more difficult to, I guess, to complete that. And once you complete this essentially mathematical equation, it creates or finds a Bitcoin. and that the amount of CPU energy, literally computer power energy, that is being used is off the charts, like, you know, equivalent to, I don't know, multiple countries around the world. And you've got people who are mining Bitcoins because they have the ability to essentially create money and I guess expend money to create this money with the hopes that it will increase in value from where it is today to tomorrow and so on. Are the other currencies also created in mind in the same way?
Some of them are just sort of spun off of existing other, like these ICOs I've been talking about, like Banana Coin. You don't actually mine that. That just gets issued, they issue a finite number of them by a company, and you can buy them or not buy them. Some of the other, you mentioned the Ethereum blockchain, which is where a lot of these altcoins live, and that is also mined the same way that the Bitcoin blockchain is mined. And may even have some improvements over the Bitcoin blockchain, which, is, as you mentioned, has turned out to be really a problem in terms of how much power it uses. And, of course, it just keeps going up and up and up. You know, in the early days, you could sit at home and mine Bitcoin, and people who did this, right, might have 10 and 20 and 100 Bitcoin simply from mining it on their own home computer. Fast home computer, right? But today there are these giant mines in China using huge amounts of energy that might spit out one Bitcoin every month or two or something, right? It's just an enormous change in the amount of energy. And just as a side note, that's interesting, the you know, what you mostly use for these are these processors called graphic processing units, GPUs, which were developed to run games on, you know, to power the video needs of advanced computer games. And the market for these has been taken over by Bitcoin users. And so game players are starting to complain that they can no longer afford to buy monitors to play their games on, because as fast as they can build these things with more and more power, they just get swallowed up by these Bitcoin mines.
Okay, interesting. All right, so now let's move to blockchain. You've mentioned it. What is blockchain technology?
So blockchain is the software that I mentioned before that that generates what we just talked about is blockchain software. That has to be that is a big piece of software these days that you run on your computer, and it does two things that are connected. One is to ensure that transactions happen properly, so that when I send you some Bitcoin, it actually gets to you and nobody steals it or makes a copy of it or anything like that. And the other one is to generate new Bitcoin. Those operations are connected. The idea behind blockchain is that it's a piece of software with many thousands of copies running on separate computers all over the world that are talking to each other, but they aren't running the software together. And that creates this kind of redundancy, so that, you know, anybody can join that network or drop out of that network at any time. It doesn't affect it. It keeps running. They like to use the word decentralized for this, because there is no one central place where the blockchain software is kind of authorized to run. It has over time become what looks a lot like centralized, because those giant mines in China and so forth dominate this network and do sometimes 30 and 40 and 50% of the mining in a very small number of locations, huge locations. That's the point of the blockchain, is that it's, you know, the easiest way to think about it is it's like a database. It's a database that, instead of running on one computer, runs on all these other computers that are constantly checking each other to make sure that they are each have the same authorized copy, and nobody's cheating and nobody's, you know, adding entries that they shouldn't be adding. That's the model.
Let me see if I conceptually understand this. So it's like a huge ledger that everybody, it's almost like a huge Google Doc that everybody is sharing and making sure is accurate, so that no one person can change it without everybody else knowing and preventing that change on some level.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's exactly correct. In fact, there's developers use a site called GitHub to track software that they build, and they use a version of this technology, not the blockchain, but some of the underlying algorithms. And that's exactly, it's like a big shared Google Doc, and you want to be sure that if anybody changed the software, that you can see that it was changed.
Okay. And so that is the way it sort of it polices itself on some level. It is, I guess, theoretically, that's what creates its security. How secure is that? I mean, the computers are theoretically, right, observing this massive Google Doc and making sure that nothing, nobody is unilaterally doing something that they shouldn't be doing. How secure is it?
I think it's fair to say that that thing itself, the blockchain, is very secure. I think we have seen the only real technical way that people have come up with to break that network is if somebody can own more than 50% of the computing power in the network. And people have come close to that, but that is a pretty big investment. And the people who have come close to it have appeared to be mining for their own legitimate reasons. They haven't done that simply to hack the network. But part of the problem is that the Bitcoin promoters focus on that particular issue, right? The fact that the blockchain network on which the Bitcoin runs is largely unhackable. And we can accept that. The problem is that that network needs to interface with the rest of the world all over the place, right? It just in the simplest thing, unless the world went over to Bitcoin, you're going to need to exchange your Bitcoin for dollars at some point. And those places where you exchange the Bitcoin for the dollar, they're not secured by that Bitcoin network at all. And they are hackable, and they have been hacked again and again and again, and people have lost huge amounts of money just from this one function of trying to exchange your Bitcoin for dollars or other national currencies. So you could say, yes, the Bitcoin network is unhackable, but that is a bit of a misleading statement.
Okay, so it's like saying the highway is very safe, but it's the off and on ramps which are problematic.
Right.
And so, right. And when we talk about these off or on ramps, we're talking about something like Bitrex. Is that right? And or Coinbase, which is sort of like
right.
Bitrex
or
is,
Mt. Gox or okay. Or we could go on and on. And in fact, you may know that there's a bunch of people on Twitter and elsewhere who focus on this exchange called Bitfinex, which offers this very strange piece of cryptocurrency called a tether, which is supposed to be a way of exchanging a Bitcoin or other currency for a dollar. The tether is listed as USDT, US dollar tether. And people have really started to wonder whether this is at all a real thing or just a completely inflated scam that is being used to bilk people out of huge amounts of money. And this has been, the worry has been exacerbated in the past few days because the company that produces Tether promised to be audited to show that they really had the money to back this thing, and the auditor just pulled out of the audit a few days ago.
That to me sounds a little bit like the old trick that you'd pull when you go to a parking lot that's closed on a day, an outdoor parking lot, and you pretend like you're the guy who runs the parking lot, and you just start taking people's cash, letting them park their car, and you just walk off.
That is not a bad analogy at all.
Okay, so with a basic, I mean, hopefully we now have at least a basic understanding of what these things are. Now let's talk about your thesis, which is that Bitcoin and maybe the blockchain technology which enables it is not as value neutral as we are. I don't know if we're led to believe or we assume or whatnot. I mean, and maybe we could say use our own money as an example as to whether or not our own money in the way that our own money is issued. I'm talking about the U.S. dollar.
Sure.
Whether or not there's actually if that's politically value neutral. But which is easier for you to start with, do you imagine?
Let me start by saying I don't think any of those things are value neutral, right? And sometimes people have suggested that I think that, you know, any criticism of the dollar or any criticism of the Federal Reserve or something is some kind of conspiracy theory, and I do not believe that at all. There are many, many reasons to criticize the way the Federal Reserve manages dollars and the way the Federal Reserve works and the way fractional reserve banking works and so forth. These are all very legitimate objects of criticism. But the Bitcoin software is predicated on a very particular criticism of these institutions that is, to me, that is just not credible. And it only had any traction in mainstream U.S. discourse in conspiracy theory. And the right-wing conspiracy theory. I mean, you hear Alex Jones talking about the kind of stuff that the Bitcoin people talk about, you know, where they depict the Federal Reserve as these corrupt bankers who are manipulating the price of the dollar in order literally to line their own pockets. You know that literally the people who are running the Federal Reserve, as if the Federal Reserve isn't largely audited and we don't have some sense of how it actually works, and as if they are actually printing money, which is a, you know, one could say metaphorically they're printing money a little bit, but in reality they don't do what people describe as printing money.
All right, well, wait a second. So point that out. Let's be a little bit more concrete with what you are attributing to Bitcoin promoters, and B, what is not accurate in your mind.
Sure. Okay. So one thing we didn't mention is that one of the reasons the blockchain becomes more difficult to mine for Bitcoin as time goes on is because the number of Bitcoin that can ever be produced is limited to 21 million. And the reason that whoever built Bitcoin, which is a pseudonymous person named Satoshi Nakamoto, said that we should only have 21 million Bitcoin is because the dollar is unstable and inflation steals value from ordinary people in a very direct way. And the way to counter that is to have a hard currency like gold, the number of which that are in circulation doesn't change. And this is gold bug theory, you know, and I worked on Wall Street for a long time, so it's something I heard about a lot. The idea that having a discrete number of something determines how much it's going to be worth. And if you examine the history of gold and so forth, you know that this isn't true, right? Gold has gone up and down in value for a lot of different reasons. Having a defined value of it just doesn't actually get you what the people claim, right? And the people who do claim that are often trying to sell you gold and platinum and right. so forth.
And we should add that pegging your currency to a finite commodity means that you have no flexibility to operate and deal with business cycles or economic cycles, and at one point you literally run out of money, I guess, right? I mean, if we were pegged to the gold standard again, and we went off it, I guess, in the early 70s, we would not have the ability to, say, have a stimulus when economic activity has declined.
You've actually given a more rational accounting of it than I think the people who say the stuff that, because you talked about pegging a currency to a finite commodity. Right, and that's a recognition that there is some kind of regulatory relationship between the currency and the commodity. And the people who recommend Bitcoin don't even recognize that. They seem to think that there just is this one thing, this currency, which they call Bitcoin, which does not have, which just exists out in this hard unit, you know, this where there's only one thing ever. And this is just, I'm having trouble finding the right words for it, but the Bitcoin's own price volatility and the way it trades in markets disproves this on its face all the time.
Right. They think it's in a vacuum. But any time that you're talking to somebody about Bitcoin, the first thing they do is they assess it relative to the value of other currencies. And so it's,
absolutely,
it's not in a vacuum any more than anything else is in a vacuum.
And they, one of the things that, one of the recent developments is that I think the Chicago Board of Options has issued, you know, has started selling futures for Bitcoin. And futures are a form of leverage, right? They're a form of making bets on the price of something that is outsized compared to the actual amount of the thing that you are betting on. And that leverage is exactly what you would have to get rid of if you really believed you were going to create an economy that was only dependent on the finite number of tokens that you have. And since they're getting rid of all regulation, that, I mean, they would like to, they can't get rid of that kind of relationship, right? So you see margin lending and all kinds of derivatives and so forth being developed for the Bitcoin network, even though that is in direct contradiction to the economic philosophy they claim to be promoting.
All right. Well, so wait. So let's get back to the original point of that the Bitcoin was born out of this notion that the Federal Reserve is a is what, and so let's talk about the sort of that underlying, I guess, belief and why it's wrong. I mean, because certainly I think there's, you know, I am one of those people who feel like there needs to be a lot more transparency with what the Fed is doing, particularly coming in the wake of the financial crisis where, you know, they helped certain people and didn't help other people. But but speak to that criticism, because it also seems to me that while they don't, while the Fed obviously doesn't have literally print money, they create it by simply saying, like, you know, going into a bank and saying, like, we're changing your ledger, essentially. But continue.
These are all the Fed. These are very reasonable criticisms, right? And to me, the place I look for people like the Fed to be governed better is government and regulation, right? I want oversight. I want transparency. I want people to be able to look into what they're doing and decide whether it's actually beneficial. The solution the Bitcoin people have is to get rid of all regulation, and then they believe that somehow out of that will emerge a better version. Well, they think it's more like algorithmic, right? If you only have 21 million Bitcoin, that's going to do all the work that the Fed is supposed to be doing. There's just no evidence of that in history whatsoever. And it might be a side product of what they're doing in some way, but getting rid of regulation to me is what, you know, a big part of what caused the 2008 crash and a lot of other crashes before it. And it, you know, just so happens to be what the kind of most rapacious capitalists really want, to just get rid of any ability of government to oversee what they do. Let me just answer the first part of what you said, which is the Federal Reserve thing, right? That since the beginning of the Federal Reserve, there has been a prominent line of American conspiracy theory about it, which builds on earlier hard money conspiracy theories that have been around for a long time. From, you know, we don't remember it today, but there used to be a silver standard as well as a gold standard. And when the U.S. decided to abandon the silver standard, I think this was in the 1870s or 80s, and move over to the gold standard, there was a tremendous amount of writing about how this was done by Jewish bankers from Britain named Rothschild, who wanted to steal American money and you know, put it all into gold, something that we can't even really conceive of today. When the Federal Reserve was born in the early part of the 20th century, this stuff came back with a vengeance. And there are writers like Eustace Mullins, who were, you know, very prominent anti-Semites, and the John Birch Society. And they just, you know, the John Birch Society's newsletter used to be full of railing against the Federal Reserve as this, you know, enormous, what he said at the time was a communist plot to steal Americans' money from us and give it to, you know, the Jewish bankers. And I just, right, I don't, I, the Federal Reserve, I think, is doing some bad stuff, but I don't think it is actually Rothschild bankers who are stealing the money and putting it in their own pockets, at least not directly. I'm not saying that the big bankers don't benefit from our interest
right.
rate policies. They probably do.
Let me ask you this. What was when these stories are spun, right? I mean, are they... I imagine some people sincerely believe them, but what, from the perspective of wealthy people in the John Birch Society, let's say, what is the value of us being pegged to gold, what is the value of, why do they have a problem? What's the real problem they have with the Fed as opposed to sort of like the stories that are built around it? Or is it, do they all sincerely believe it's just simply a way to filter money to the Jews?
You know, this is a question I have asked myself, and I've tried to do some research into it, and it is really unclear to me. I think that there definitely is, to some extent, some of these wealthy people have a lot of their money in these hard assets, right? And so they are simply defending the assets that they have. At least the way I read it, I think this is a very useful form of political discourse that they have that may not be all that directly about it may not be that they care that much about the specific interest rates policies of the Fed. Now, I do know that they would like to get rid of the Fed altogether, and it's hard for me to imagine what our economy would be like without central banking. And maybe they would benefit from it in some way that I don't fully understand. But I think that's an open question. I mean, it is the case that, as we talked about before, right, that there are a lot of people out there selling gold and platinum and silver. They happen to be on Alex Jones and other places like that, and they certainly have an interest in telling us that, you know, gold is the real hard asset and we don't want to be in the dollar and so forth.
Right. And these things aren't mutually exclusive. I mean, they will enhance each other's your ability to believe that gold is really important, and also coincidentally having a garage full of gold is they're related. All right. So with that said, what else about Bitcoin is an expression of right-wing extremism?
I really focus on the economic aspects because that is just where you happen to see this really significant overlap between the what I think is properly called extremism. It just so happens that the people who promote these views just tend to be very far to the right. I think a little bit less extreme, but still of real concern, is the anti-government bias that is even more prominent in the Bitcoin community, right? To me, that is simply like hard right as opposed to the extreme right, the hard libertarian right or whatever. But when Bitcoin talks about decentralization or eliminating the middleman or getting rid of regulation, all they are talking about all the time is government and how evil government is and how government is, you know, a corrupt thing that, again, exists to benefit the bankers or whatever. And, you know, their solution is to get rid of it, which I think is... You know, which is just like what we've heard from the GOP with regard to 2008, right, where you had a crisis that was largely caused by deregulation, and the solution they proposed was even more deregulation instead of regulation, which, in my opinion at least, is the thing that would help to prevent it.
So it's not just that that people who that 8 out of 10 Bitcoin supporters are espousing a certain right-wing perspective. It is that the concept of Bitcoin is and these other cryptocurrencies is founded in an extreme distrust of the state and a belief that somehow a currency can function without any without being tethered to a state and without having any regulation other than the behavior of everybody who is using Bitcoin.
You've said it very well. And in fact, I can add a little bit, which is we talk about blockchain, right? And there are these discussions of non-currency functions of blockchain. And the most famous one is called smart contracts. And the idea is that you would be able to write a contract and put it out on the blockchain, and then it would be self-executing. It would execute via machine algorithms, and there would be no need for lawyers or judges to intervene in that process at all. And again, there is a desire to eliminate what most of us would say, even if it's very cumbersome, but is a really important function in society, that, you know, the relationship between lawyers and judges and so forth and legislatures, and they would just like to get rid of it. And, you know, there is people have written some good papers about the social function played by lawyers and judges and so forth, and how just eliminating this is just really distasteful.
Well, I mean, it's also, I mean, there has to be a way to adjudicate and to and arbitrate these things. I've had conversations with libertarian thinkers and intellectuals, I guess, that have proposed the idea of my court, their court, and then a third court to adjudicate the results from these separate courts. Which, yes, was my response as well. But in this instance, like, what? All right. So, I mean, I don't understand, like, is the idea that Bitcoin is going to supplant currencies? Like, what is supposed to happen with, I mean, I, you know, listen, I have no problem with, these things being commodities. Like, you know, I had baseball cards. That's great.
right.
But yeah, what is supposed to happen? Like, how does this continue to maintain value? How does it edge out existing currencies, right? Because if this is a state-free currency, my understanding is our money maintains its value because the state has a monopoly of force and says, you need to pay taxes. We will only take taxes in the form of American U.S. dollars, and therefore it has value, because if you don't give it to us, you go to jail. And so everybody's going to agree to take this because everybody owes us some taxes to pay their dues to society. Where will Bitcoin get its value if it's not volatile? Like, if it is just a system where will it get its value?
Right. This is a huge problem, right? And some of the more thoughtful Bitcoin people have started to admit that this hugely exploding value is actually, you know, contradicts its desire to function as a currency. And so there is a little movement now to develop what they're calling stable coins, a coin that would have the same value all the time and that could function as a currency. And I can't technically evaluate the proposals. I guess we'll wait and see if they work. But it is hard to understand how people are incented to keep running this network when the coins themselves may never be worth more than they are worth at any given time.
That's the thing, is that as far as I can tell, the primary driver at this point of interest in Bitcoin is that, like, I want to buy it when it's, you know, one Bitcoin is worth $8,000 and wait for it to go back up to $16,000. And but that precludes it from being a currency because I, as a vendor, like, I don't, you know, I need some, I need to be able to know tomorrow what it's going to be worth to set my prices. I guess, unless, you know, it's like a side thing for me. So I don't understand, where does a cryptocurrency that does not have the promise of increasing in value, where does it get its value?
That's unclear. And it's, as you suggested also, it's unclear why anybody would want to use it. If we go back to the days when Bitcoin was being used a little bit more as a currency, people have done some work on this, and the bulk of those currency transactions were for illegal goods. And this was being advertised by the Bitcoin people as great because they hate the state, and, you know, so anything the state outlaws is wonderful. But, the fact that you have this currency that is somewhat useful for buying drugs and buying weapons and other kinds of stuff that happens on the dark web, I think, is not very attractive to most people. And so then you wonder, what's the point? I mean, so far the cryptocurrencies, because they hate middlemen so much, they hate all the services that middlemen provide, right? They love to attack Visa and MasterCard, for example, because they have transaction fees. But Visa and MasterCard have all kinds of fraud protection and chargebacks. It's pretty funny to get in the Bitcoin communities and read about chargebacks. You and I might think chargeback protection is a terrific thing. If somebody steals my card and spends $10,000, I don't owe the money for it, right? Whereas if somebody steals my $10,000 worth of Bitcoin, that's it. And I think that's a value add that I am somewhat pleased that I have to pay a little bit of a transaction fee toward. But the Bitcoin people think, it's a demonic.
Is it possible to have a cryptocurrency that is not conceived in right-wing ideology?
To me, the problem is that the model itself is built in this kind of right-wing ideology because it is so hostile to government and so believing that a kind of absolute free market is going to, the invisible hand of that absolute free market is going to produce a ethical and just society. I just don't think that's true. And I don't even think a real left anarchist would want to believe that that's true because there's such a pre-built-in free market aspect to it. People want cryptocurrencies to be available across the political spectrum. I'm not always convinced by these efforts, but they have, there have been some interesting ideas about trying to peg a currency to labor more like direct work hours or altruistic actions that you take in the world. These are all really, there are some people working on money, right? Ann Pettifer is a person who writes about money. There are ideas that we might alter some of the basis that through which money is created. I think those are very interesting ideas. I'd still probably rather see us implement them as a society and make a decision through our democratic institutions to do that than I would to have some ad hoc hacker system of people who just go and build their own system and tell us it's great. Now, that really required a lot of people to start using it, so there is a somewhat of a democratic aspect to it. But I still think we are, for the most part, with such a central issue as money, we're better off going through the institutions we have built to handle those things.
Well, the politics of Bitcoin, David Galumbia, I feel like this is just chapter one for us in terms of exploring this. It is an extremely contentious topic. And it's one of those topics where I feel like everyone feels that no one else gets it. And, yeah. and perhaps that is also, money itself is a very difficult concept that people have. There's a lot of controversy about, even with a currency that we use every day. Yes. And so it makes sense that there is a lot of different perspectives on this. But I certainly appreciate yours. The book is The Politics of Bitcoin, Software as Right-Wing Extremism. And we will put a link to that at majority.fm. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay. And we're now going to head into the fun half of the program. Kyle will call in the fun half, the top of the top of the fun half, top of the hour. We're at the top of the hour. Just 5 past the hour. Kyle will call in and talk to us a little bit more about blockchain. And then I presume about 30 other people will call in about their perspective on Bitcoin. But we said we were going to do it. We've done it. It's done. Did it. Folks, it is your membership that makes this show possible. Unfortunately, we had invested a large part of what we had generated in terms of an operating budget in 2017 in Bitcoin. I don't know if you've been following Bitcoin as of late, but it seems to have dropped significantly from when we bought it at its peak at, I think it was at 16, let's see, Bitcoin price was, I think we bought it around, well, I guess we bought it. What was that? We bought that about 16, 17,000, Brendan? Brendan was like, now's the time to get in, he said to me. And I think this was probably in the first week of January. You're like, 2018, time to be bold. Let's take this to the other, the next level. I think were Brendan's exact words. And that was around, the price was around, I think, 16,000. Now it's down to, well, I mean, it's up from 1 a.m. this morning. But right now it's at about $6,100. So, okay. You know. Anyways, JoinTheMajorityReport.com. JoinTheMajorityReport.com. It is your membership that makes the free show possible. And as a way of saying thank you, we say, hey, here, look at listen to all this other stuff that we give you. Hodgepodge of sound drops and comedy. We don't know when what's coming when. But that's just the way it goes. You can look at our... you can look at our show descriptions. Somebody asked me, like, how can I get to the best parts of the fun half? And I was like, I don't know. I mean, I don't even know what you would think is the best part. I'm not you. Let's just keep that in mind, folks.
I'm not you. That's the kind of customer service that you can expect.
That's right. JoinTheMajorityReport.com. Also, JustCoffee.coop, Fair Trade Coffee, Tea, or Chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Folks, call your congresspeople right now. Right now, stop what you're doing. Call your congresspeople. You can go to whoismyrepresentative.com. Call them. It is unclear right now if the Democratic leadership is whipping against this bill. Nancy Pelosi has said she's voting no on this continuing resolution because it doesn't have DACA in it. There are reports that the Democratic leadership is discouraging, that's the word that was used, discouraging people from voting for the continuing resolution. I don't know, frankly, and I don't know if anybody knows what that means on a continuum versus whipping against it.
She's going to look at you disapprovingly.
Okay, so
like Marge Simpson.
According to Politico Playbook, Dem leadership has sent out a note urging a no vote on the budget deal. Again, in the continuum of, you know, there is in diplomatic language, you get stuff like deeply concerned, seriously worried. There is actually, it's a, internally, they know, in that world, they know where this rises on the spectrum. Like, oh, we got a deeply concerned from the United States. I mean, we can do it, but we're just going to have to put out two press releases that say this and that. It's unclear to me. If they were whipping, we would probably know it's whipping. Urging is different. But that's where the Democrats are, and we'll see. The Democrats could keep this bill from passing depending on what the Freedom Caucus does. According to Jake Sherman, still a lot of Democrats want to vote yes. The look, and I can explain this dynamic to you in 20 seconds. The agreement that they're voting on extends SCHIP for 10 years. Includes an $80 billion in disaster relief funding, $6 billion in, toward opioid mental health treatment, $5.8 towards the Child Care and Development Block Grant, $4 billion towards VA, $2 billion toward research at NIH, $20 billion towards infrastructure, $4 billion towards college affordability, $7 billion in funding community health centers, defense building. Let's see, defense would go up by $80 billion, and on domestic, it would go up by $60 billion. And so in those districts where They feel like I don't have any, I don't have a big immigrant population. Those are the people who want to vote yes. I mean, broadly speaking, that's what I would guess. So call your congresspeople. All right, quick break, 646-257-3920. When we come back, we'll be talking to Kyle Shank. Don't forget, check out TMBS. You can find it on our YouTube channel or on iTunes. And Jamie's blog is at Patreon. Jamie Peck. Be back in a minute.